Hi, I'm Janet. I'm recovered from compulsive eating and bulimia.
Hi, Janet.
Hi there. So I guess I'll tell you what I used to be like, what happened, and what life is like now. So I went into my first meeting. I was 15 years old, and I was already the kid who would walk out of school to go across the mall to buy, you know, a chocolate chip cookie and end up eating tons of them, and stealing food, stealing money for food. And when I was just shy of my 16th birthday, some kids in my high school were in, started bringing like salads and half a chicken for lunch to school. So I said, what'd you do? So they told me about OA, and I went. And I spent my next 6.5, 7 years till I was 23 in OA, getting worse. I walked into a meeting and I could admit that I was powerless over food. And so people said, great, you admit you're powerless, now here's a food plan, stick to it. And I, for the longest time, I thought, that doesn't make sense. It's like, I don't know, it's like telling someone saying, you have terminal cancer, now that you know it, make your cancer cells stop multiplying. And I never could. And the reason is, I was at the point of being powerless. And the big book says lack of power, that was my dilemma. So I walk in and I admit I'm powerless, but how, you can't expect someone who's powerless to have power. So I didn't. You know, the steps are really about moving from point A to point B. So I'll tell you about the 6.5 years. I would hear things like, don't eat and go to meetings. And I would think, if I could don't eat and go to meetings, I'd don't eat and go to the movies and not spend my life in church basements. I had 50 different sponsors. I'm not exaggerating. I had about 50 different sponsors during that time. When I started, it was in Florida. And the way it worked is you did 30 assignments and you were abstinent for 30 days and then you got a plant. And I never got that friggin' plant in 6.5 years. Because I couldn't get abstinent. I did what I was told. I would write, abstinence is the most important thing without exception. And I would say, I'm binging because I'm miserable. And then one day, I was 17, and this 20-year-old boy asked me to a Beach Boys concert. And there's like nothing better than that when you're 17 in Miami. And I binged. And I thought, I must be trying to sabotage my happiness. And that wasn't true. I binged because I had an illness. So here I was, 15, 16, binging a little. Let's fast forward 6 or 7 years, binging a lot, throwing up to 6 times a day. I ended up having to have the valve on my esophagus tightened because it just became too loose to keep food down, you know, healthily. So I was a mess. I was doing things, stealing food. If I had a boyfriend and he wasn't giving me enough attention, I would take a razor and just like cut myself up and pretend I'd been mugged or something to get him to pay attention to me. Not caring about anyone except myself. And I would think, well, I'm so lonely and that's why I do this stuff. So, but I guess the real diagnosis, not, you know, not lonely, not this, was I was a mess. And what I learned was that I had an illness. So here I was, 23 years old, and I was at, I don't know if any of you remember the Concord. It used to be the annual OA convention. So I was there binging, and someone stood up. She actually held up a big book, and she had these ringlets of blonde hair. She looked like an angel to me. And she said, I haven't binged in a year. A year? In 6.5 years, I couldn't get, you know, I think once I got 2 weeks together, I couldn't get abstinent. And she said a year. So I went up to her after and I said, tell me what to do. And she said, well, first go read this book. Read the first 164 pages. So that night, I skipped the talent show. And I just went up in my room and I read the book. And the next day I went to her and she said, okay, are you willing to do everything that's in this book? And I said, well, there's this one amend. It was to an ex-boyfriend who, you know, I'd done the razor, cut myself, had him take me to the hospital for an exam, the whole bit. And I said, I don't know if I'm willing to make amends to him and go back and tell him it was all fake. And she said, are you willing to trust that by the time you get to that step, you'll be a different person? And I said, okay. So shortly thereafter, I embarked on working the steps. And I remember going to a meeting that she went to, and this was a meeting where newcomers were allowed to ask questions, which is a great idea. So I said, raised my hand, and I said, I've been in the program for 6.5 years, and I'm still binging. And this old-timer said, you may have been going to meetings for 6.5 years, you have not been in the program. And I felt like, maybe there's hope. Maybe someone's telling me the truth. You know, at the beginning of There Is a Solution, it says, there are thousands of men and women who have recovered who were once just as hopeless as Bill. So what I got for my first 6.5 years is I got a lot of well-meaning people who gave me false hope, saying things like, don't worry, it will get better. If we were in Cancer Patients Anonymous, no one would tell someone who had cancer, just keep coming to meetings, it will get better. Because on its own, this illness doesn't get better. In fact, the book tells me it's a progressive illness, it's fatal, and it gets worse. So what I had to do is I had to start working the steps. There's something I'd heard recently. People talk about step zero, put down the food. I don't know if that's made its way down here. So that really flies against what it says in the big book, because the book says on page 24 that there comes the point in the life of every abnormal drinker, eater, where the most powerful desire to stop is of absolutely no avail. So I couldn't just put down the food. So the book told me lack of power was my problem, and that my job was to find a power greater than myself. So my job was to move from point A, where I was powerless, to point B, where I had power. How do I do that? Well, you know, step 12 opens with a promise. It says, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, then we tried to carry this message. And they define a spiritual awakening as a personality change sufficient to overcome alcoholism or compulsive eating. So I used to sit in meetings, you know, during my first 6.5 years, and I'd say stuff like, well, I haven't put down the food yet, but I have more serenity. Or I don't have as many resentments. And what that was just bull. It was just perpetuating my own denial syndrome, because we could see angels dancing on the head of a pin. If we're still eating compulsively, we haven't had the kind of spiritual awakening that the big book talks about. And that's what I needed to save my life. So step zero, if we want to say that, is really on page 59. It says, in order to work the steps, it says, if you have decided you want what we have, what do they have? A spiritual experience, a personality change so strong that the desire to binge is just going to be yanked out of me. You want what we have and are willing to go to any length to get it. Then you are ready to take certain steps. So someone says, you know what, I'm not willing to go to meetings. I'm not willing to be on a food plan. Well, call me when you're ready. It says for those people, we offer them friendship and fellowship. We don't say don't come. But I wouldn't sponsor someone who says I'm not willing to do it. But something I've learned to be careful of is someone says, well, I'm not willing to put the food down. People say that, and I don't think they mean that. What they mean is, I haven't yet been able to put the food down. Because if someone wasn't willing to put the food down, they wouldn't be here. Unwilling means, if my fairy godmother were to strike me recovered so that the desire to eat compulsively would be lifted, would I say yes or would I say go away? And we'd all say yes, of course. And then if we're willing to do the work, so now we can get down to business. So step one, admitted we were powerless over food and our lives had become unmanageable. It took me a long time to really understand what powerless means. And powerless means that I can't do anything about it. And, you know, we all know, like with, I don't know, cancer, pneumonia, there's a virus and it spreads and this, but how does this work? Is it an allergy to sugar? Well, no, because, you know, if someone has an allergy to, let's say, strawberries, they just stay away from strawberries. So, and I, in fact, have a severe cat allergy. So I stay away from cats. I don't go near a cat. And let me find on page, I think it's 24, it talks about what our defense is. It says, most alcoholics or compulsive eaters, for reasons yet obscure, so we've all just saved $20,000 in therapy. They don't care about why we became that way, right? Because why do we really want to know why we became that way? So we know who to blame, right? But they say, for reasons yet obscure, we don't know, we don't care. We've lost the power of choice in drink, or for us, food. Our so-called willpower becomes practically non-existent. We are unable at certain times to bring into our consciousness with sufficient force the memory of the suffering and humiliation of a week or a month ago. We are without defense against the first drink or compulsive bite. So they're telling me that my defense against the first compulsive bite is my memory? Well, okay, I can understand that. So when it comes to cats, I remember my memory of the dangerous behavior, going near a cat, and then not being able to breathe, makes me not want to go near a cat. I don't say, I had a rough day at the office today, or boy, I'm mad at my husband, I'm going to go into a pet store, or I'll start staying away from cats tomorrow. No, because I remember, so I don't go near it. But what if someone took a scissor and snipped that connection? And it's like, that's what happened with food. So I would binge and purge, let's say, 5-6 times and feel awful. I'm never going to do this again. So you would think the memory of the addictive behavior goes up, the memory of the consequences goes up, my behavior goes down. There was a snip. And there is no way to ever put that back together. So I cannot rely on my memory to fix me. So the book says, I think it's the last line of chapter 3. Yes. The alcoholic, compulsive eater, at certain times has no effective mental defense against the first drink, the first compulsive bite, because of what my friend calls the snip. No defense. So, no mental defense. His defense must come from a higher power. So if I don't have a defense here from my brain, I need another kind of defense, and that's a spiritual defense. And this book has dual themes running through it, faith and works. So as my spiritual activity goes up, my tendency to want to eat compulsively goes down. And the spiritual activity, the book talks about, really consists of two parts, faith and works. And the faith means trusting and relying on God. It means doing the right thing and leaving the results up to Him. And works means self-sacrifice for the good of others, especially for us helping other compulsive eaters. So how do we go about doing this? It's not like we're just, God says, or the founder said, okay, you had the snip, you got to go build up your spiritual life, good luck. No, they said, we'll write you a book. And this book's going to tell you exactly what to do. So the first step, we admit we're powerless over food. We go back and we look at our history and say, yep, the snip, that applies to me. My memory can't do it. I'm sunk. I'm desperate. Now, just realizing that does nothing, right? Because I'm still at point A. I have no power. I got to get to point B where I have power. So how do I get from knowing I have no power, which until that I'm not going to be motivated to do anything. How do I get there? Well, we start going through the steps. So we admit we're powerless over food and our lives had become unmanageable. And the symptoms of an unmanageable life, for anyone who just wants to look at them later, it's on page 52. You know that paragraph, we were having trouble with personal relationships, we were prey to misery, depression, couldn't control our emotions, all that. So that's step one. So we say, okay, yes, I'm powerless. I want to move from A to B. How do I do it? So step two says, we came to believe a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. And what is so beautiful about this is it tells us, it says, as soon as we were able to lay aside prejudice and express even a willingness to believe in a power greater than ourselves, we commenced to get results. And in the next paragraph it says, as soon as, so immediately, we admitted the possible existence of a creative intelligence, a spirit of the universe, we began to be possessed of a new sense of power. That's what I need, power. And direction. That means I want to be moving toward point B. Full power. Power and direction, provided I take other simple steps. Keep working the steps. And then what a beautiful line follows. We found that God does not make too hard terms with those who seek him. And they say it's impossible to fully define or comprehend that power, which is God. So through the years, I've heard people say that higher power can be the group. Higher power could be a light bulb, a chair. But the big book is really clear that it's God. Now, it's our own conception of God. But at the very least, it's a spirit of the universe, a creative intelligence. If I made the group my higher power and all of you go out and binge, I'm in trouble. And even if you don't binge, can you really stop me? Can you really give me a heart change? Not at all. So the way it worked for me is I went to the meeting and I was just desperate and I took a sponsor who I think number 51 would not be the same as the others. This person's like, what are you willing to do? And I said, whatever you tell me. And the sponsor lived about an hour and a half from me, and I remember thinking, I hope I'm not asked to move to be closer because I'm so desperate that I will. But I wasn't asked to move, but I was asked to, you know, really work hard. But I said, okay. And that night I went home and I said a prayer. I said, God, I've always had fixed ideas of what you were like and what you wanted of me, and I'm willing to admit everything I know is wrong and let you show me what you're like and how to worship you. And I'd been stuffing bagel chips down my throat right before that meeting, and it was just like a hand reached in and yanked the obsession out. But I believe it wouldn't have stayed yanked out if I hadn't continued. So step three is we made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. So that meant I was no longer going to wake up and say, what do I feel like doing today? I was going to wake up and say something along the lines of, here's your servant Janet, God, reporting for business. You know, or in whatever form it is, and to let go of control. So some examples of what that may look like. I have two middle school kids, and I make them lunch every day. And half the time, the lunch gets, I make them great lunch, healthy, gets uneaten, and not returned back, so it could have tomorrow, but like left out, so it's, you know, would have to throw it away. And I was starting to get really angry, and I was talking to someone, and I realized my job as a mom is to make the lunch. What they do with it is outside of my control. If I'm sponsoring someone, I give them the information. If they recover, that's wonderful, and I'm thrilled. If they don't, and whether they do or not, it's not my business. My job is to just pass on what was passed on to me. To not have to have my way. In fact, to be the one who does the self-sacrifice. If it's raining and snowing out and someone's got to go put a dime in the meter, to be the one to volunteer. To look for what God would have me do. And I think one of the most helpful lines in the book is, just to the extent that we do as we think he, God, would have us do and humbly rely on him, does he enable us to match calamity with serenity. So a few years ago, I would get a little nervous or fearful that my son was going to, now he was like 10 at the time, because he was, you know, very active, that he was going to grow up to be like a Skid Row alcoholic. And then I realized, you know, it's my job, and I wanted him to behave a certain way. And I realized, it's my job, out of my obedience to God, to raise him a certain way, to parent him, you know, with patience, love, discipline. However he turns out is none of my business. That's hard when you're a mom, but that's really how we have to live our lives. Like, we do what we think God would have us and let go of the results. So I made a decision to do that. I've been living that way, some days better than others, but that's always my goal. I did a four-step. So in the four-step, I looked at my resentments, and then I looked to see, and it's funny, at one point I did a workshop and I diagrammed out through the big book, there were, I think, like, what, 7, 8 steps for resolving resentments. First, we write who we resent and why. Then we pray for the person. Then we pray to see our part. And it was usually because I wanted something to go a certain way and someone was thwarting my ambition. So I got angry. Then, so I did my four-step, went through it with my sponsor, and when I was done, it was like getting a new pair of glasses. The best way I could describe it was like trees looked greener. And the way the big book described it, this is why they sell hardcovers, because I'm missing about 80 pages in the middle of the book. But it says, let me try and think of it. It's after the fifth step, it says, we feel we are walking hand in hand with the spirit of the universe. The feeling that the drink problem, food problem, has disappeared will often come strongly. So again, I start out here, I'm moving here, now I'm about here. So the obsession's getting a lot less. And for me, I was able to stick to a food plan this whole time. One thing my sponsor had said to me at the beginning is, you have to be honest. The first time you lie to me, I'm dropping you. And I remember at one point telling a lie to someone and sitting there terrified that when I told my sponsor, I was going to get dropped. But the book says, if a man is trying to recover, he will be honest, even if it means the loss of his job. For he knows he must be honest if he would live at all. So I made a decision that I was just going to be honest, and I fessed up, and you know, I didn't get dropped because I think my sponsor saw my sincerity. But I made a Herculean effort to be honest. I was a compulsive liar too. I mean, you know, went around telling people I'd been mugged all the time. So what I did, if I said something that was untrue, I would just say, you know what I just told you, that wasn't true, I'm sorry. And until it got to the point where I had a change of heart, and now if something untrue comes out of me, it makes me feel like I'm gonna throw up, like in a bad way, not in a bulimic way. I'm saying it just makes me like sick to my stomach. It's not who I am anymore. The sixth step, we become willing to have God remove our defects of character. And in the seventh step, we ask for them to be removed. So I did. I had a list. I asked for them to be removed. So when I did it, I had a date with the boy who I had really liked, and I had done all that like faking that I'd been, you know, attacked to get his attention. And we were getting together that night. I think I hadn't seen him in a while. And we went out, and you know, he wasn't in love with me, which I don't know why. And I came home and I felt a little bummed. And I said, wait a second, I've done a 7-step. That means I could choose to not be depressed. And I could. For the first time in my life, I had mastery over my emotions. In the 8th step, I made a list of people I had harmed, stores I had stolen from, people I'd been rotten to, went over it with a sponsor because we don't want to cause more harm by, you know, saying things we shouldn't. I made the amends. And then page 84 is the most beautiful promises. It tells us what happens after the 9th step. And it says, for by this time sanity will have returned. We will seldom be interested in alcohol, food not on our food plan. If tempted, we recoil as if from a hot flame. We react sanely and normally, and we will see that our new attitude toward food has just been given to us. So I started out insane, and remember the insanity was my memory failed to stop me from eating compulsively. But look what they talk about, a restoration to sanity, which has two parts. It says, one, we will seldom be interested in alcohol or food not on our food plan. Like, not interested. If tempted, we recoil as if from a hot flame. So now when we see a hot flame, we don't sit there and say, maybe, yeah, no, it'll burn me. It's automatic. It's just part of our being. We know hot flames burn us. So we've moved from here. By the end of step 9, we're here. We're at point B. We now are in a state of recovery. And then it's living in steps 10, 11, and 12 to maintain that. So step 10 is a daily inventory where we look to see, was I dishonest today? Was I fearful? Was I resentful? And then we go ahead and resolve it. The 11th step is praying and meditating for knowledge of God's will and the power to carry it out. It doesn't do much good if I say, okay, God, here I am reporting to duty, and I have no idea what he wants me to do. So it's really taking time to just get quiet and say, God, I pray for knowledge of your will for me and power to carry it out. And what I do sometimes, I say, okay, God, the next 15 minutes, I'm going to sit quietly. If you have something you want to impress upon my mind, you know, I'm setting aside this time just for you. And often I'll write down anything that comes. And it's not often that, I get anything major. But every now and then, for me, it will come with a line from the big book or a line from the Bible. That just something to get something. Or just a feeling of something that's right. Or I'll say, please increase my desire for whatever is right. And help me to be okay with whatever your will is for me. Step 12. So step 12 starts out with that beautiful promise. Having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps. That I was going to have a personality change strong enough that I wouldn't be obsessing about food anymore. So, so that's the beginning of step 12. That I would have that kind of personality change. And then my job is to carry this message to other compulsive eaters. And it talks about this message. So I'm not allowed to carry my own message. I have to carry this message. And chapter 2 is called, there is a solution. Like not 50 different options. There's one solution. And in fact, in the original first edition of the big book, now it says we know thousands of men and women who were once just as hopeless as Bill, nearly all have recovered. The original said, there are 100 men just as hopeless as Bill, all have recovered. So when this program is worked, the way it's outlined in this book, there's really a 100% success rate. So there's just a couple of other things in this book I just want to quickly touch upon because they just really meant a lot to me. So one is the part, I think it's on page 20, so it's still in here, where it talks about the different types of drinkers. You know, it says there's the moderate drinker, the hard drinker, and the real alcoholic. And they talk about the moderate drinker as someone who has trouble stopping, but when they have to stop, they can. So I think of my husband. He was 10 pounds overweight about 10 years ago. The doctor said, you have high blood pressure, you need to lose 10 pounds. I don't know how he did it. He lost 10 pounds, never made a big deal about it, kept it off. I don't understand earth people, but you know, there's some people who are like that. And it says, then there's the hard drinker. And it says, this person is further advanced and may even need medical attention. So even some people who have to go to rehab for alcoholism, they haven't crossed the line to real alcoholic. And these were the people who would puzzle me because they would go into OA and they needed it. They needed the structure and the hugs and the, you know, formats and the food plan and the accountability. And they got better because they needed that. Then the book says, but what about the real alcoholic? And what it talks about for a real alcoholic is we need a miracle. That's why I was in OA, as I said, my first 6-7 years, and so saw these people coming in and getting better. And they weren't really working the steps, they hadn't crossed the line to a real compulsive eater like I had by age 15. Why me and not them? As the book says, we don't know. Doesn't matter. But I had. So I needed a miracle. This book talks so much about miracles. When the person first goes to visit Bill Wilson, he says, here sat a miracle directly across my kitchen table. And the end of We Agnostics actually says they have the formula for a miracle. Do we all know the story? The minister's son, he's locked up for being an alcoholic, for drinking. He says, if there is a God, he hasn't done anything for me. And then he says, what if I'm wrong? What if everyone else is right and I'm wrong? And it says, while pondering the answer, he felt as though he lived in hell. Then, like a thunderbolt, a great thought came. It crowded out all else. Who are you to say there is no God? He tumbled out of bed to his knees. In a few seconds, he was overwhelmed by a conviction of the presence of God. He never drank again. And then they say, what is this but a miracle of healing? Yet its elements are simple. Think about that. They're telling us, like, the elements are simple for water. Two hydrogens, one oxygen. That's simple. The elements of a miracle, they're telling me it's simple? Yeah. And they say, circumstances made him willing to believe. Circumstances, step one, admitting that my brain isn't going to be able to stop me, that I can't stop myself. Circumstances, my powerless, made him willing to believe. Step two, he humbly offered himself to his maker. Step three, then he knew. It's not like God just comes right out at first. We have to go, we usually go because there's no other options. It's the last stop on the train. And the last thing, I just want to say a couple words about fear, because in my life, in my recovery journey, it's been one of the things that's been one of the hardest to surmount. And my book skips a page. Okay, so I'm going to have to try to remember. I have resentment. I don't have fear. Okay. So it talks about, it says, fear is an evil and corroding thread. And it's set in motion trains of circumstances we thought we didn't deserve. So if faith can actually do something. So faith, you know, recovery here is different from recovery from, let's say, pneumonia. If I have pneumonia and someone sneaks me penicillin, even if I don't know it, I'm going to get better. If someone says to me, oh, it's really Tylenol, I'm going to get better. I don't need to have any faith that the penicillin's going to get me better. But when it comes to this program, faith is actually part of it. It's like when I say, okay, I believe, or I'm willing to believe, that God, as I understand God, can help me. It's almost like an angel up there opens a door and says, good, now we can get to work in her heart and do something about it. Faith actually does something. It allows the force of good in this universe to come in and start working on me. Fear does the opposite. Fear basically says, God, go away. I don't trust you. So I think it's really important to just to replace fear with faith. And the book tells us exactly how to go about doing it. It tells us exactly how to resolve any problem. It says, we sit quietly when in doubt, asking what to do. And then the final thing, it says, our very lives as ex-problem drinkers depends upon our constant thought of others and how we may help meet their needs. And I like even better how Bill says it on page 14. If an alcoholic failed to perfect and enlarge his spiritual life through work and self-sacrifice for others, he could not survive the certain trials and low spots ahead. If he did not work, he would surely drink again, and if he drank, he would surely die. Then faith would be dead indeed. So they're saying, my job is to perfect and enlarge my spiritual life. How do I do that? Through work and self-sacrifice for others. What's a self-sacrifice? For something to really be a self-sacrifice, it means there has to be something I want for myself that I don't do in order to do something for someone else. We're real good at saying, oh, we do so much for others and we don't think of ourselves. we're really not the best at self-sacrifice, and we have to be self-sacrifice. And then it says, if we don't, we can't survive the certain trials and low spots ahead. I've started doing CrossFit lately to, you know, build up my muscles. The work and self-sacrifice for others is how we build up our spiritual muscles. For the certain, unfortunately, it says that's one thing that's certain, that there will be trials and low spots ahead. And if we haven't built up our spiritual muscle, we're in trouble. But if we do, we're okay. So what this program really is about is going from lack of power, point A, to point B. But it's not my power, it's God's power. And I think he's just up there waiting for all, you know, hunting us down. I love reading the stories, because in most of them you could just see how God's just like hunting us down, you know, out of his love for us. And it's just a story about come home, and while you're at it, bring a few friends. Thanks.